Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley and Markkula Center for Applied Ethics program. My name is Lisa Kloppenberg, and I serve as Dean of the Santa Clara University School of Law. It is my pleasure to introduce Kenneth R. Feinberg, founder and managing partner at Feinberg Rosen LLP, and author of Who Gets What? Fair Compensation After Tragedy and Financial Upheaval. After graduating from the University of Massachusetts and New York University School of Law, Ken worked as an assistant attorney for the New York Department of Justice. He later joined Senator Ted Kennedy's office, becoming chief of staff. He served as special counsel to the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee and then as an assistant U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York. Ken soon established himself in private practice as one of the country's most high-profile mediators. He has orchestrated major settlements in cases ranging from asbestos damage to Vietnam veterans exposed to Agent Orange. Through some of the most horrific tragedies in recent years, Ken has been able to maintain an unwavering level of integrity and empathy. He worked pro bono as special master of the September 11th Victim Compensation Fund, which distributed nearly $7 billion to more than 5,000 victims and families. He oversaw the $20 million BP Gulf Oil Spill Fund and monitored executive compensation plans at several companies that received federal bailout money. Ken also served as the administrator of other victims' relief funds, including the 2007 Virginia Tech shootings, the 2012 Aurora Theater shootings, and most recently the Boston Marathon Bombing Fund, which distributed over $35 million. I highly recommend his first book, What is Life Worth?, describing the difficult considerations and heroic human beings he encountered in distributing compensation for the 911 victims. It will make you think about what constitutes fairness in a world that does not always prize justice and in a legal system that cannot fully redress all moral wrongdoing. Even busy law students in the audience should read it. It's short, straightforward, and I promise you, you can finish it over your holiday break. One of the most important lessons I learned from Ken when I was fortunate enough to work with him in my early years of law practice was that we always negotiate in the shadow of the law, yet we can always work to make the negotiation setting as fair and just as humanly possible. As a mediator, Ken always tries to ensure that the processes he establishes are fair to all the interests involved, that they provide voice for all viewpoints, even when those voices express grief and anger, and that the processes preserve the rule of law so foundational to our civil society. Ken is keenly aware that his work cannot remedy every tragedy fully, but with compassion and conscience, he strives to help people find peace and healing and fair, sustainable solutions to complex problems. In 2004, he was named Lawyer of the Year by the National Law Journal and has repeatedly been honored as one of the most 100 influential lawyers in America. He has taught at Georgetown Law since 1977 and has been a major figure promoting alternatives to litigation and a problem-solving mindset in legal education. Ken, it is such an honor to hear from you. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Ken Feinberg.
I want to thank the dean for that wonderful introduction. She mentioned both of my books. What is Life Worth? Public Affairs Press, 2005. Who Gets What? Public Affairs Press, 2012. Now, you may have trouble finding these books today in your local bookstore. don't worry. My personal supply of these books is virtually inexhaustible. And if anybody has any trouble, let the dean know and we'll manage to find you a copy. I also want to thank the Commonwealth Club here in Silicon Valley for the opportunity once again to talk about some of my work, and a particular thanks to the Markkula Center for Applied Ethics. One reason, among many, that I decided to take advantage of this speaking opportunity and to come from the East Coast to Santa Clara was to visit the Markkula Center and also to talk for a few minutes about the ethical conundrum I confront every single time I'm asked to do one of these programs. It doesn't matter if it's 9/11 or the BP oil spill or the Boston Marathon or Virginia Tech or the shootings in the movie theater in Aurora, Colorado, or Sandy Hook, the shootings of the first graders in Connecticut. In all of these problems, certain ethical dilemmas, not philosophic, academic ethical dilemmas, but what the center focuses on, applied ethics, what ethical decisions have to be made when you're the Pazar, determining compensation for certain corporate executives, or any one of these tragedies. And I want to just spend a few minutes summarizing the problems that come up when you are compelled by policymakers to design and administer these programs, and some of the real stressful ethical decisions that aren't academic but have to be made every day. For example, the 9/11 Victim Compensation Fund. Let me just use two examples to make my basic point. The 9/11 Victim Compensation Fund, a statute passed by Congress 11 days after the terrorist attacks. And that fund simply stated, anybody who lost a loved one on 9/11, airplanes, World Trade Center, Pentagon, anybody who was physically injured as a result of those attacks could voluntarily make a choice, waive their right to litigate. Don't go to court. Don't sue the World Trade Center. Don't sue the airlines. Don't sue Boeing. Don't sue the military. Don't sue Massport. Don't sue the Port Authority of the City of New York and New Jersey. Forget it. And instead, enter a very generous public compensation program funded entirely by the taxpayer. By the taxpayer. Now, there's never been a program like this in American history, and I doubt very, very much there'll ever be another one. But that program that I was asked by President Bush and Attorney General John Ashcroft to design and administer paid out, as the dean mentioned, over $7 billion in 33 months. Tax-free, public taxpayer money. The program worked. I think it worked exactly as Congress intended. I think it was the right thing to do at the time. It was a patriotic initiative. And I think Congress spoke for the American people in setting up a very successful program. Only 94 people who lost a loved one on 9/11 decided to litigate rather than come into this fund. Only 94. 5,300 people came into the fund and were paid. It worked. It worked better, I think, than Congress ever thought it would. And I think it was the right thing to do, and I think it was a success. Don't ever do it again. Don't ever do it again. You talk about an ethical dilemma. You should have read some of the emails I received during my administration of the fund. Mr. Feinberg, I lost my son in Oklahoma City. Where's my check? Dear Mr. Feinberg, I don't get it. My wife died in the basement of the World Trade Center in the original 1993 attacks committed by the very same people. How come I'm not eligible? And it wasn't just terrorism. Dear Mr. Feinberg, explain something to me. Last year, my wife saved three little girls from drowning in the Mississippi River. And then she drowned a heroin. Where's my check? You know, you better be careful when you set up very special programs just for the few. Everybody else, fend for yourself. But for you, generous compensation, the average payment in 9/11 by the fund, tax-free, $2 million for a death claim. $2 million. You're trying to attract people not to sue. $400,000 for a physical injury claim. How do you justify ethically, politically, socially, carving out for very special treatment just you few? Everybody else, you're on your own. I caution against using public money to compensate innocent victims when every day our nation grieves for innocent victims. We did it then. No other program I know of was set up in the wake of tragedy to compensate victims using public taxpayer money. And then you have the second ethical dilemma. In any of these tragedies, whether it's 9/11, the BP oil spill, the Boston Marathon, Virginia Tech, who gets what? Who's eligible? How much money do you give them? How do you decide? Now, let me tell you a basic problem of human nature that I confront, ethical and psychological, in all of these programs. The first problem. In absolute dollars, how much money is enough? How much money is enough for a death? Mr. Feinberg, I lost my daughter at the Boston Marathon in April, a few months ago, the victim of an attack. A bombing. Mrs. Jones, we're going to pay you for your daughter's death. $2,225,000. Tax free. Do not expect thank you. Do not expect appreciation. Do not expect gratitude. A mother loses a daughter and you give her a check? Compensation. That's the American way. That's the free market system. That's laissez-faire economics. But let me tell you, money in absolute dollars, you could give that mother $10 million. Don't expect thank you or gratitude. Money is a very poor substitute for loss. And you confront this ethical dilemma. Applied ethics. How much do you pay? How do you value a lost life? Now, that's only the first problem. Because human nature being what it is, there's a second problem. It's not only how much you pay the victim, but how much are you paying the next door neighbor? Everybody counts other people's money. It's human nature. Because, you see, when you say, I'm going to give you X, and I'm going to give your neighbor X plus Y, right away, emotion rules, you see. Mr. Feinberg, you're giving my next-door neighbor $500,000 more than you're giving me. Why? You never even met my husband. Why are you denigrating his memory? Well, Mrs. Jones, you know, people die every day and they don't get anything. I don't want to hear it. I don't want to hear it. You're giving my next door neighbor more money for a death, more for a memory than me. You are denigrating the memory when I'm trying to validate through dollars the value of a life. You can't win. When you take on these assignments, the first rule, brace yourself. No good deed goes unpunished. Be careful what you wish for. Expect the worst. And it's inevitable. And it's understandable. And you empathize with people, you see. You empathize with them. Now, even with something like my role as the special master for executive compensation, the Pazar. My grandmother wouldn't know what to make of that term, I got to tell you. She wouldn't get it, but all right. The Pazar. Now, here's the ethical dilemma with the government determining what a corporate official in the private sector ought to make in the way of annual compensation. I thought when I took on that rather unique assignment, another statute that will never be replicated, I don't think. I look upon the Special Master Pazar job as sort of populist revenge by Congress following in the wake of the TARP bailout of all the companies that would have otherwise gone belly up as a result of the 2009 financial meltdown. But here's what I learned about the government calculating what a private corporate official ought to make in the way of annual compensation. First of all, the government really shouldn't be in the business, and we all acknowledge that. So let's not get into an ideological issue. I don't think anybody, including the Secretary of the Treasury, thought that the statute was a great idea. But all right, the Congress passed it. It's the law. But here's the dilemma you run into, that I ran into. Mr. Jones, you work at Citigroup. I've done my evaluation and my research, and you're going to get 50% less in compensation than you did last year. Now, I would have thought I would have got in an argument with that corporate official over material gain or loss. Now I can't have another car. Now I got to sell my house on Cape Cod. Now my kids will have to go to public school instead of private school. I thought, like most Americans, I think, I would get in a debate over how much money do you need to live the good life? No. You can deal with that problem rather easily. The real problem is when, as I found out, corporate officials that I was dealing with see their compensation as a reflection of self-worth. As a reflection of self-worth. Not family as a good barometer. Not community service as a good barometer. No. Mr. Feinberg, if you cut my pay, you're telling me that my own self-evaluation of what I bring to my life, to my society, to my family, has been challenged by your arbitrary decision-making. And when money becomes the barometer of self-worth, self-evaluation, self-integrity, you are in a very emotional, shaky world. And you get into very ethical dilemmas with people you're arguing with about self-evaluation of commitment and value to society. It's not about another car or another home. It's about a mirror of what I bring as a human being to the society of which I am a part. A law degree? Let me tell you, my law degree in something, in an argument like that, I'd rather have a divinity degree. Or a degree in psychiatry, not law. These are problems that come up. Applied ethics. Take the Boston Marathon 3 months ago. Through the dedicated, amazing efforts of the mayor of Boston, Tom Menino, and the governor of Massachusetts, Deval Patrick. In 60 days, One Fund Boston raised $60 million. Million. 60. Newtown, Connecticut, $11.5 million. Virginia Tech, $7 million. Aurora, Colorado, $5 million. Boston, $60 million. I am amazed at the charitable impulse of the American people. It's all private money. All private money. But now, you sit in a room, around a table, with your fellow lawyers and those assisting me. How much of the $60 million should be allocated to the families of the four who died? How much should be allocated to two double amputees, to 14 single amputees, to people in the hospital over 30 days, to people in the hospital 3 days, to people who never set foot in a hospital but raced to the emergency room, got a splint put on their arm and were sent home? How much? Who gets what? And you're making very ethical determinations. Very ethical determinations. First, how much of the $60 million should be reserved for the dead? Now, in our system of law, as you know, nothing is more final than death. So that even somebody who suffered horrible physical injuries, lost limbs, in the eyes of the law, death is the most valued. We said, there's $60 million, let's set aside $40 million. No, that's too much. There's four dead. Let's set aside, for out of the $60 million, let's set aside $10 million for the dead. There's only four, thank goodness. I say only in quotes. Unlike the 3,000 who died on 9/11. Then, how much should we allocate for double amputation? The same as dead. Single amputation, $1 million less. And a sliding scale for as long as you've been in the hospital. Over 30 days, $950,000. 3 to 4 weeks, $750,000. 2 to 3 weeks, $450,000. Rough justice. Rough justice. Ethical questions loom large. Why more for the dead than those with lost limbs? Why more for X than Y? And why do you give everybody in the same boat the same amount of money? Why shouldn't you say to the banker who loses a limb, you don't need the money as much as the $35,000 a year laborer with four children. So we're not going to give you as much. You don't need as much. Who am I to say who needs? Who am I to make that determination? You try telling somebody who just lost a limb, we're going to give you less, you don't need it. Or, we're going to give you less because we think you're a banker and you made more, but send us your tax returns. We want to look at your pension, how much money you have in the bank. Ladies and gentlemen, you go down that road and you are fueling the very divisiveness among injured victims you're trying to avoid. But you confront this problem of human nature that money is a very poor substitute for loss. I went to a hospital in Boston to meet with one of the victims who lost a limb. Mr. Jones, you lost a limb as a result of the Boston Marathon, and you're going to receive $1,250,000. He looked at me. Mr. Feinberg, keep the money. Give me my leg back. How's that? You can keep the money. Give me my leg back. Mr. Jones, in the 9/11 fund. Mr. Jones, you lost your wife at the World Trade Center. We're going to give you $3 million tax-free. Mr. Feinberg, I got a better idea. Find a way for me to be in the World Trade Center instead of my wife. I'll substitute. Bring her back and I'll take her place. What I do, ladies and gentlemen, is not rocket science. There are people in this room who could do exactly what I'm doing, just as effectively, if not more so. It is not, you don't need a degree in astrophysics, and you certainly don't need a law degree. Because what you're dealing with in all of these examples, and we could spend a whole seminar at Santa Clara delving into the idiosyncrasies and the nature of these programs and the decisions that have to be made. But this Marco Lacenta tonight, this is the place to talk about the real common denominator in all of these programs, the ethical issues as applied that you confront every day in trying to define and implement public policy. You cannot avoid these decisions. You need a healthy dose of resoluteness, determination, empathy. And remember, money, when you're talking about horrible tragedy or trying to value what somebody thinks they've contributed to society, money, that the decisions you're making are a pretty poor substitute for loss or for self-worth. So I think the work that's being done here every day at this center is incredibly important in delineating a practical element of all of these compensation decisions that I make. What is the right way? What are the moral boundaries of what I do? How do you justify ethically, morally, as a matter of public policy, these decisions? Not easy. But if the President of the United States or a mayor or a governor or an attorney general asks you to take on the assignment, you do it like you would do it. And that is why this is a great forum for raising some of these issues. Now, we have a few minutes. And I welcome questions and or comment.
Ken, thank you for that very moving, I think, an insightful discussion. My name is Steve Diamond. I'm an associate professor of law here at Santa Clara University, and I want to sort of get the conversation started, and a couple people have submitted questions. But let me just ask you, one of the things you said repeatedly in your talk was, this will never happen again. And yet something seems to be happening again and again, because your phone keeps ringing, and you end up being the person in the room. So I wonder if you've thought about what's changing in American society or culture or economy that is creating these circumstances where your skill set, your background is called upon.
Two answers to that very good question. First, when I say it won't happen again, I mean that I doubt that you'll see a 9/11 fund happen again, where a compensation program is established by Congress, funded by the taxpayer. All of these other programs, Boston Marathon, Virginia Tech, Aurora, Colorado, that's all private money. That's charity coming in over the airwaves, watching television, people sending in private donations. So that's the first point. I don't think you'll see a public compensation program. I certainly haven't seen one since 9/11. There was no 9/11 program for Katrina, for Hurricane Sandy. Secondly, I think these private programs are proliferating. I see more and more of them in Connecticut, and Virginia Tech, Boston Marathon. I think it's something to do with copycat. Everybody now, it's 24/7 cable TV. You turn on the news, you see what's going on. The American people have an outpouring of sympathy. They write out a check, they send it in. It's sort of... These funds proliferate, but I still think they're aberrations. I still think that the likelihood that we'll see private funds for every horror that confronts the American people, I think that's unlikely.
But what does seem to be happening is this idea that somehow we should hand the question of deciding the sort of outcomes of these difficult situations to a single individual. And with respect, you're not an elected official. You're not a judge, you're a private citizen. And yet, time and again, we're turning to you instead of our ordinary traditional legal system. What's gone wrong with the legal system that we need you?
It's not a good idea. It's not a good idea to delegate to one person largely unfettered discretion to design, implement, administer these programs. There are students here from Santa Clara, distinguished students from Santa Clara Law School, that have taken administrative law. Be careful about delegating in the interest of efficiency, speed, systematic treatment. Be careful about giving too much authority to one person. I'm only as valuable as my last assignment. One of these days, if I fall flat in my face, I'll be off to Mars or Pluto somewhere in retirement. I think you raise implicitly a very important question as to whether or not it's good political science and sound public policy to confer so much authority on one person. I'm dubious about it.
Well, should we clone you? Should we institutionalize, in other words, should we institutionalize the role that you play to handle situations big and small at different levels of government or society?
First, I don't think you have to clone me. I think, as I said, there are plenty of people, American citizens all over this great country, that can do what I do if they were asked. Secondly, if you try to institutionalize what I do, I don't think you'll be successful. I think what drives these special programs more than political science or an understanding of law is the emotionalism of the moment. The idea that you turn on CNN or your local news channel and you witness as it's unfolding what's going on, and there's a tremendous charitable reaction by the American people to all of this, and the result is these programs. I don't think you can do it in advance. I don't think there'd be an institutional will to create them in advance. I don't think it's a good idea to create them in advance, tell you the truth.
Now, several times you suggested that what you really do is a form of kind of rough justice that perhaps any of us could or we perhaps think we might be able to, but I think most of us were probably skeptical that we could do as good a job as you. And I wonder whether, and a number of people have asked, whether there's some particular ethical or moral outlook that you've absorbed from childhood or your own experiences in American life that provides some deeper guidance to how you resolve these situations.
I'm asked that a lot. I think there is. I think I grew up in Massachusetts in the late 1950s, the early 1960s, where there was a communitarian ethic fostered by President Kennedy, a son of Massachusetts. And I think that, like millions of Americans, I was impressed and ingrained with this notion of giving back to you, to your country, and giving something back to the community. I'm distressed today to hear how all these attacks on government and how government can help people. I think government has a very, very important role to play in American society today. So I think that communitarian ethic, I also think that this notion of collective grief, which is so imperative and such an integral part of Judaism, which was part of my faith, I think that reinforced the message that I was hearing from President Kennedy. And I think those are the twin pillars of why I feel so strongly, like I think millions of Americans feel strongly, about the importance of helping your community and helping your fellow citizens.
Well, certainly one of the things that's changed since that era is the diversification of American life. And one of the things that you've certainly been exposed to, you've been in a number of different situations in different parts of the country, and you're getting involved in a face-to-face way with a diverse group of American people in times of stress and conflict. Do you sense that within that environment there's some new urgency or feel for an alternative approach?
No. The people that I have two answers to that. When you meet people in grief, brace yourself. I mean brace yourself. It's all emotion. Mr. Feinberg, I lost my wife. We were married for 25 years. She died at the World Trade Center. And I'm here to tell you she was a great lady. And I'm not here to talk about money. I want to show you a video of our marriage 25 years ago. I want you to see her. What an angel she was. It's not about money. It's not about calm reflection on what life is worth. It is about emotional anger, frustration, disappointment, anxiety, and better a priest or a rabbi than a public official doing this, a lawyer certainly.
Well, that leads to one question from our audience. How do you deal with the great anger that you sometimes face, and do you have any advice for those of us who are in the legal profession who have to deal with some of these kinds of issues?
Well, you listen. You empathize. You never respond in anger. I mean, sometimes people say to me, you know, Ken, that woman that you met with, she lost her husband. She was so insulting. She was so angry. Why didn't you just tell her off? She lost her husband. And we're here to give her money. You can't get angry. You listen. You try and empathize. And you try not to lose your professional detachment. You've got an assignment, calculating dollars, and it gets very, very difficult because you're dealing with people not only who are angry but who are frustrated about life's unfairness. And you become a listener, and you become, as best you can, a handholder, and you try and get through it, but it's not easy. It's not easy.
Well, here in Silicon Valley, of course, one of our focuses, even obsessions, is business and innovation and companies. One of the essentially effects of that is to create lots of change, lots of upheaval, but also lots of inequality, lots of unevenness, lots of different results for different people, and you began to allude to that in your comments. Could you share with us what your exposure was to that or thoughts about that issue when you were dealing with the pay issues and the sort of devastating impact of the financial crisis?
Well, I hoped when I did the Payzot job that everybody would get in an objective discussion over material gain, right? Well, you're not going to get paid $2 million because people like you make $1 million. You're not going to get paid. You're asking $4 million. We're only going to pay you $2 million because our objective analysis is that a CFO in a company like yours should get $2 million. That would be easy, relatively speaking. The problem becomes, you see, when it gets very personal. Very personal. You're raising, Professor Diamond, you're raising a good question about diversity and the growing income gap between the very wealthy and the line people working at the company. That's a big problem in American society today. I didn't confront that problem. I wish I had. You have answers for that. I confronted the problem where somebody looks at you and says, how dare you cut my pay? I'm worth all that money that you're cutting. And then you get into a very emotional harangue, you see, and you can't win. Because how do I know? When somebody says, I look in the mirror and I'm worth the $4 million, nothing you can say is going to change his view of his reflection of self-worth. So it gets very, very emotional, very, very subjective, and very, very difficult to respond. You listen and say, well, I've got to do what I've got to do.
I sensed when I read that chapter that you felt some frustration that, in a sense, your role there was much more constrained and you weren't really able to have the kind of effect on these businesses and on the problem itself. And I wonder whether you think that we've dealt adequately with this issue or are we setting ourselves up for potentially greater risk in the future in the financial system?
We haven't dealt with that issue of Wall Street pay. I must say, if you're a historian, like some of you are, from the very founding of our republic, there's been this tension between Wall Street and Main Street. That, you know, you can go back to Hamilton versus Jefferson, and J.P. Morgan, and everybody else. I mean, that is an ingrained part of our heritage, Wall Street, high finance versus Main Street and Sinclair Lewis. I mean, that goes back 200 years. But I think that what Congress did with the Payzot was symbolic. Don't forget, I only had authority over 175 corporate officials, individuals. That's all. I doubt very much that I had much impact on the rest of America in terms of corporate pay, but it was populist revenge by Congress. They wanted to demonstrate to the American people that they were going to do something to those corporate officials who only survived because of TARP and the financial bailout by the American taxpayer.
Well, do you think some of those businesses, as complex as they were, would have actually collapsed if those individuals had been paid maybe $250,000 a year instead of $2 million a year?
They made that argument. They said, if you don't pay our CFO, she's irreplaceable. Well, first you say to them, to the company, the graveyard is filled with irreplaceable people, right? That's the first thing you say. And the second thing they used to say to me, all of them, that is, if you don't pay her what she's worth, she's going to leave. And you know where she's going to go? She's not going to go to a taxpayer across the street. I mean, to a company across the street, a competitor. She's going to go to China. Everybody was going to China if you didn't pay them. Everybody's headed to China. Well, they're still there. We didn't buy into that argument. The money is being repaid. I don't think anybody can realistically and effectively deny the necessity or the beneficial impact of the TARP program of President Obama and President Bush. And I think that those programs prove their worth.
Well, I think it's very easy for us to forget how we've built a kind of public base underneath our most effective corporate private entities. Here in the Valley, of course, the background is that the government played a significant role through defense spending and other kinds of research to support innovation. Here are some questions from the audience. Each of the programs you've administered sounds exceedingly trying, both logistically and emotionally. I know you often don't accept direct payment for your services. What keeps you coming back each time, or do you just relish the controversy?
You don't relish it. I'd like you to say no to President Bush or President Obama or the Attorney General of the United States or the Mayor of Boston if they call and say, Ken, we would like you to serve. I mean, this is a request from policymakers. Now, remember, I don't urge that these programs be promulgated. I don't urge that these programs for compensation be made public policy. Others do that, whether it's a president or a corporation like BP or a secretary or the Congress. If I'm asked to do it as a public citizen, I step up. And I think people in this room would step up. And that's what good citizenship, I think, is all about, frankly.
Now, the complexity you describe in each of these cases in trying to decide precisely how to divide the resources, leaving aside, of course, the absolute inadequacy of financial exchange for the experience that these people have had, one person asks, why not just divide the money equally?
Well, I think there's something to that. I like that idea, dividing the money equally. That minimizes the controversy. It doesn't eliminate it. Then people are going to say, why did you divide it equally? But I like that idea. Now, you can't divide the money equally if there's too many people, because everybody will get $1.67. You have to have the money has to have an impact. And also, our society has a hierarchy of loss, which has to be factored in here. Sometimes people say to me, with very reasonable, you know, somebody who lost both limbs and has to move on in life at the age of 31 ought to get more money than the family of the four who died. Death is terrible, but the person with no limbs needs the money more. And they can make a very reasonable argument about that. The dean talks about negotiating in the shadow of the law. The law does not recognize that. The law recognizes death as the ultimate pinnacle of loss, of valued loss. And all of these programs that I've been involved in reflect that death is the worst. Permanent loss. But after that, I'm in favor of as much equitable distribution as is possible. It minimizes conflict. And you know what else it does? It minimizes your overhead. If everybody's getting the same, you don't need tax returns. You don't need medical doctors to review medical records. You're not going to delay getting the money out. You're not going to have a lot of costs associated with your overhead. One size fits all. The money can get out a lot quicker to the people who need it. And then the other thing is, there's no substitute for getting the money out the door. All the talk in the world is pretty hollow if the money isn't going out to the people who need it.
Now, some of these situations are obviously not random necessarily. Obviously, we're talking about terrorist attacks. Those were intentional, but they weren't private actors like a British Petroleum. Does the situation change when you're dealing with a private corporation that caused the problem in the case of BP as opposed to the terrorist acts?
Well, the situation changes in the sense that you've got a private entity fronting the money. So you're not looking to the taxpayer for money. So that makes a difference. Frankly, I'm more willing to get paid for my services if there's a private corporation involved. They're fronting the whole cost of the program.
Well, do you find people coming out of the woodwork demanding
money? Oh, build it and they will come. In the BP oil spill, I received in 16 months 1,200,000 claims from 50 states. I got over 300 claims from California. I didn't know the oil got this far.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Over 400 claims from Massachusetts, 40 from Alaska, and then 35 foreign countries sent claims in. Most of them denied, I might add.
Well, what's the toughest situation you faced?
9/11. 9/11 was the toughest because you were dealing with a horrific attack on America, rivaled only by the Civil War, Pearl Harbor, and the assassination of President Kennedy. People who said perfunctory goodbyes to loved ones, see you for dinner, will you be home early, never saw him again, incinerated. Dealing with that type of traumatic, instantaneous grief. I've never done anything quite like that before in my life. And that'll be with me a long time, that whole experience.
Do you feel that your relationship with the victims in these circumstances provides a kind of balm for their grief?
Not at all. My relationship with the victims is hands off, arm's length. Pay the victims. Here's the money. It's all we can do. We can't bring back your loved one. Move on as best you can. Don't call me. Let's not have a reunion. This is it. Move on. And since 9/11, it's been over 10 years, I've received every 9/11, I get one card, and usually flowers or a box of candy, from one of the families who lost a loved one. That's it. And that's the way it should be. Move on as best you can.
Now, when we were at dinner, we had an interesting conversation, and I wondered if you could share with the audience as well. You've been mentored by some really fascinating legal figures, and perhaps that was just good luck, or maybe it was a good opportunity for you. What was it about those experiences with Senator Kennedy, Justice Breyer, that perhaps contributed to your ability to be effective in these circumstances?
These were mentors who provided me not only political support in terms of moving forward and meeting people. They taught me how to be a lawyer, how to negotiate, how to be flexible, how to be creative. Senator Kennedy, one of the most effective U.S. senators in American history. Justice Breyer, when I worked with him as a lawyer, we were both lawyers on the Senate Judiciary Committee staff, watching Justice Breyer's skill in fashioning arguments and honing in on what was important. Jack Weinstein, a federal judge who I started my career with him in the Agent Orange Vietnam veterans case, he's still sitting in Brooklyn, 92 years old, federal judge. Professor Robert Potofsky at NYU Law School, my first professor, all very, very important in teaching me how to think, how to be effective. Very important.
Well, it's certainly perhaps not as bad as it was in Shakespeare's day when it was said the first thing we should do is kill all the lawyers, but lawyers in American society have a rough time of it on occasion, and I wonder whether you think there's some lessons here in the experience you've had for how we ought to be thinking about the role of lawyers in society.
The lawyers in American society play a valuable role. They are part and parcel of American history. I think our legal system is second to none in the world. Yes, we have problems with our legal system. Show me a profession that doesn't have problems. But day in and day out, in every village and town in California and throughout the nation, lawyers serve the public interest. I'm honored to be a lawyer. I think the students attending Santa Clara Law School are fortunate indeed in entering a very noble profession. Now, that doesn't mean to say that there aren't situations like a mass tragedy involving hundreds or thousands of deaths and injuries where there has to be a better way than litigating for years and years in the courtroom. But let me tell you, I've seen in all of these tragedies great work that lawyers do in representing grieving clients. So I think that our profession is always should be open to innovation and creativity and change where needed. But as a profession, I'm proud to stand tall with the fellow members of my profession. I think that overall they are an essential aspect of American life.
Well, in some ways, what you do in this intervention and these crises and trying to resolve these conflicts is steer people away from the courtroom. And, of course, it's a natural instinct among many Americans who are in a certain circumstance like this. They want their day in court. And yet you have to convince them that there is something right in front of them that really makes more rational sense. And I wonder if you'd share any thoughts about that experience.
First of all, I don't plan these programs. Policymakers do, Congress, the president, state legislatures. I'm asked to design a program once somebody else has decided to have a program. But I do think that I'm asked all the time, what features of these programs help assure success? And the answer, give people an opportunity to be heard. Tell them, Mrs. Jones, you lost your husband at the World Trade Center in 9/11. Come on in and talk to me in confidence about it. Mr. Smith, you can't fish in the Gulf of Mexico because there's oil as a result of an oil spill. Come on in. Let's chat. Mr. and Mrs. Jones, you lost your first-year-old child in Sandy Hook, Connecticut, in Newtown, the victim of a deranged gunman. My office door is open. Give people an opportunity to be heard. It is always an integral, essential part of any program that I set up to compensate should include an opportunity in confidence to meet with one person, a real live person, and let those people vent about life's unfairness, that somebody is listening. Very, very important. Very important to the success of these programs.
Well, I think we only have time for one more question, and I wondered whether you've, in looking at these situations that we face in the United States, whether you've looked at experiences internationally, and particularly in South Africa, for example, after the apartheid experience, there was a truth and reconciliation process set up as a kind of an alternative, and a number of countries have used this approach. And I wonder whether you've spent any time looking at that kind of experience, whether you think there's some lessons to be learned for us in the United States.
I think there is a great lesson to be learned. Truth and reconciliation, I think, it's sort of antithetical, I think, to the American way. Americans, when they think of compensation and loss, think about money. And that's the way it's been from the very founding of the Republic. I also think that in South Africa and in some other countries, there is an opportunity for government to apologize. To apologize. It's very, very rare in America that your government apologizes for anything. Now, they did. President Reagan did. I remember the 1980, a law was passed by Congress. The president signed it, compensating the families of Japanese American citizens who were relocated after Pearl Harbor in internment camps. And President Reagan apologized to those families. I think a check was paid of about $20,000 to each of them. Reparations, an apology. The 9/11 fund was not reparations. There was no apology in 9/11. And I think that we can learn some lessons, I think, from Truth and Reconciliation and other ways that other countries go about compensating or apologizing or rendering consideration for innocent victims. Yes.
Well, at the outset, you suggested maybe we don't need to clone you, but have other countries or other parts of the United States look to you for examples of ways in which they're solving some of these types of tragic situations?
They can look as long as they don't call me and ask me.
That's great. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
You all enjoyed this evening's program hosted by the Markkula Center for Applied Ethics and the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we'd like to thank Ken Feinberg, attorney and author of Who Gets What? Fair Compensation After Tragedy and Financial Upheaval. Steve Diamond, Associate Professor of Law, our audience here at Santa Clara University, and those of you joining us on the radio. And now this meeting is adjourned.